I have a confession to make this morning. Some of you have been waiting for this confession for a very long time. And I want you to notice something. It's a confession. It's not an apology. There is a difference, of course. But from time to time in my pastoral ministry here, I threatened some of you with becoming a sermon illustration. Some experience, some behavior in your life so mirrored a biblical teaching that I threatened to use you to illustrate that teaching. For some reason, I've never quite figured this out, why you always assumed that the illustration would be negative. In over 25 years of pastoral ministry, I never once had a person that I threatened to use as a sermon illustration that assumed that I would use them to explain a spiritual virtue. They always assumed the worst. This morning, I'm going to get even with myself. I'm going to use myself as a sermon illustration. It has nothing to do with a spiritual virtue that I do possess or don't possess. It has everything to do with what God said He would do, and He did, for me. Now, as always, there's a backstory. Some of you know this story. Some of you know some of this story. Some of you have no clue what I'm talking about yet. But on the evening of August 8th of this past summer, I was in my daughter's backyard hitting a pickleball around with my grandson and my son-in-law. I was on the court just a few minutes when I started experiencing chest pain. It was not crushing. It was not one of those you feel like you got an elephant sitting on your chest kind of stories. It was just enough to make me nervous. And so I went inside and told Ann that what I was feeling, and as you can well imagine, within a matter of minutes, we were on our way to the emergency room. I learned something that evening, and that is that when you tell people in the emergency room that you are actively experiencing chest pain, you move up on the triage priority list really quickly. So you can use that in the future if you'd like. Within a relatively short period of time, we learned that my heart enzymes were elevated and that I had experienced what they classified as a heart episode. And even though I felt fine within about a half an hour, they told me I was going to have to spend the night for observation. Little did I know that it would be a couple weeks before I would see the light of day again. On Sunday morning, they did an echocardiogram and my heart muscle was fine. On Sunday afternoon, they did an angiogram and I found out that my left main artery was more than 90% blocked. In case you're not familiar with the anatomy, the left main artery is the one that feeds over 50% of your heart. And so, you know, it provides all the blood supply to the majority of your heart. Mine had slowed to a trickle. That's not a good thing. The interesting thing was, when it blocks off entirely, they call that the widowmaker. And so, according to them, I needed heart surgery and I needed it as soon as possible. Now, I have to tell you, I was pretty cool about all this. I mean, after all, Ann had worked on the open heart team and she had done hundreds of these, and I just knew that somehow that transferred something to me. And so I had every reason to be very comfortable with what we were doing. I felt enormously blessed. Most people don't get the warning that I got. The truth is, most people are dead before they ever know they have my problem. So I was pretty casual until Tuesday evening, the night before surgery. And on Tuesday evening, all of my family was surrounding me. The support was wonderful. But we sat around the room, and I looked around, and I remember consciously thinking to myself, this isn't good. When all the family shows up at the hospital, that's not a good thing. And I began to think about the seriousness of what I was about to do. Amy and Heather and their families left mid-evening, and Ann and I had a few more minutes together before she had to go home. But the mood had changed. My mood had changed. The lighthearted laughter was gone. There were no jokes. Nothing seemed funny all of a sudden. And I had grown fearful of what was about to happen to me. For a while, my personal concerns were greater than my confidence in my God. I started to worry. After Ann left that evening, I was left alone with my thoughts for a while, and I can remember just laying on the bed for probably an hour or so, just thinking about what could happen. And interestingly enough, not a single thought was good. I thought about all the work that I might not be able to finish. I thought about all of the family events that I might miss. I worried about what Ann would do if she had to move on without me. And the more I thought, the heavier everything in the world got. It felt like I was literally carrying the weight of the world. Finally, I sensed that the Lord was telling me to read Psalm 121. So I grabbed my iPad and I opened it to Psalm 121 and I read it. Now, I was not ignorant about Psalm 121. Fact is, a good portion of that psalm I had memorized as a small boy. But that night was different. It was like Psalm 121 had been written for me and for that moment. There are some lines in that psalm that I've probably read 100 times or more. But that night, they meant something different. They meant something more. I had a fairly good idea that Ann was still awake, and so I grabbed my phone and I texted her. And here's what I texted her. I said, read Psalm 121 and then go to sleep. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun will not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. Psalm 121 is the second in a collection of psalms that are known as the Psalms of Ascent. They start with Psalm 120, they end with Psalm 134. Pilgrims sang these psalms as they were making their journey from their home to Jerusalem to celebrate the great feasts of Israel. Taken together, the songs progress literally from the start of their journey to the point where they are worshiping on Temple Mount, worshiping Jehovah God. The second in the series, Psalm 121, tells the story of the travel to Jerusalem. Now, keep in mind, Jerusalem sits in the hill country of Judea. No matter what direction you come at it from, you're going to have to go through the hills. And the hills were difficult, and they were dangerous, and they were full of the unexpected. You couldn't get to the temple without having to go through the hills. And so the psalmist says, I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? Now, there's a question that needs to be answered in this psalm. Are the hills the source of your help, or are they the reason you need help? The question is exacerbated because of the way it was translated in the old King James Version. Any of you remember it? It went something like that. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help? The insinuation is that your help is coming from the hills. That's not the best translation. In fact, all of the more modern English translations translated identically. The psalmist makes a statement and then he asks a question. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Then he asks the question, from where does my help come? In other words, the hills aren't the source of your help. The hills are the reason you need help. Now that fits the context, doesn't it? Because the hills that surround Jerusalem are not the lovely, lush, green hillsides that we're used to around here. Instead, they were difficult and they were dangerous and they were full of unexpecteds. There were the dangers of the climb. The path was not always sure. And if your foot slipped, you could fall and you could be injured. There were dangers of heat stroke. The sun was scorching hot sometimes through that desert mountains. There were dangers of thieves. The hills were filled with bad men just waiting to relieve you of your wealth. In fact, you remember the story of the Good Samaritan? The story of the Good Samaritan starts with the story of a man who was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho through the hills. And there he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and took everything that he had. That was a common experience as you went through the mountains. The mountains were a dangerous place. And as the pilgrims approached the hills, they recognized their need for help. And so the psalmist asked the question, from where does my help come? If you think your help comes from the hills, do you know what you would find in the hills? You would find all of the cultic high places that were part of the Canaanite pagan pantheon. You would find the altars to Baal, and you would find the Asherah poles, and all of the cultic high places were there. But if you want to find your help in God, then you have to look beyond the hills to the God who made the hills. You know, you can tell a lot about a person by where they look for help. So let me ask you this morning, when you are facing the hills, when you are facing the difficult and the dangerous and the unexpected, where do you look for help? When you go to the doctor and he uses the C word, where do you look for help? When you get a pink slip that says you're being downsized through no fault of your own, when the money runs out before the bills do, when your spouse tells you that he or she is moving on, when your child needs drug rehab for the third time, where do you look for help then? Do you look to the hills? Or do you look beyond the hills to the Lord? Do you trust the Lord with your situation? Or do you insist on carrying that burden yourself and worry yourself sick? You know, I don't want to oversimplify things this morning, but I want you to think with me in terms of two circles. Some of you have heard this before. If you're taking notes this morning, you can draw those two circles, one inside of the other, an inner circle and an outer circle. We're going to do something magical. We're going to put all of your life in those two circles. And it's really not all that difficult to do. The inner circle contains all of the things that you can control. If you can control it, then what do? You find out what God wants you to do and you do it, don't you? I mean, what actions does He want you to take? What attitudes does He want you to have? How does He want you to think about your situation? And in that circle, I want you to write the word responsibilities. Now, the outer circle contains all of those things that you can't control. And in that circle, I want you to write the word concerns. Concerns are all those things that we care about, but we can't control. They're not our responsibility. Now, I don't know about you, but I care about a lot of things that I can't control. And some of them I care very deeply about. And sometimes my concern goes beyond concern. And it takes me all the way to anxiety and worry. See, anxiety is when you become so concerned that you lose your peace and security. Anxiety occurs when your concern for yourself is greater than your confidence in God. Worry takes concern a step further. Worry is imagining all of the negative possibilities and then focusing on them. It's literally meditating on the negative. You say, Don, you don't understand. Some of the things in that concern circle, I care a lot about those things. I want to control them. Oh, I understand. But you can't control them. If you could, they would be in your responsibility circle, but they're not. They're in your concern circle. That means they're in somebody else's responsibility circle. You know what I figured out a long time ago? If it's in somebody else's responsibility circle, I can't control it. You say, okay, then how do I keep from taking on all of these concerns? How do I keep from getting burdened with these concerns? The answer is simply this. You have to apply the trust and obey principle. Now, I want you to go back to our circles. And in the responsibility circle, I want you to write the word obey. Listen, if it's your responsibility and you know what to do, what do? You do it, don't you? I mean, you obey. And yes, the Lord will help you, but whose responsibility is it? It's not His, it's yours. And in the concern circle, I want you to write the word trust. You have to trust those things. All of those things that you care so deeply about that you can't control, you have to allow someone else who is far more capable than you to attend to those things. I mean, after all, what else can you do? See, the problem is that we tend to live our lives in the concern circle instead of the responsibility circle. And when we do that, we become anxious and we become worried because we're trying to control things that we simply cannot control. See, the difference between legitimate concerns and worry is where you look for help. So the pilgrims, approaching the hills with all of their unexpected difficulties and dangers, look beyond the hills to the source of their help. My help comes from the Lord. You say, Donna, I know this sounds heretical, but how do I know that I can trust the Lord with my situations? How do I know that I can trust Him with my problems? You know, there are four primary reasons why we worry instead of trusting God. And you can take all of the explanations and excuses and you'll probably wash them down to these four things. First of all, we're not convinced that God is able to help us. I mean, after all, maybe He can't do anything about my situation. Secondly, we're not convinced that He cares enough about our situation to help us. You know, maybe He's too preoccupied with running the universe. Maybe He's got bigger fish to fry than my problems and my situations. Thirdly, we're not convinced that God is willing to help us. I mean, maybe he just won't. Maybe he wants to teach us a lesson. Or he wants to pay us back for something we did or didn't do. Maybe he won't help us. And finally, sometimes we think we can do a better job than he does. Now, none of us would ever say that out loud. But our attitudes and our actions belie that, don't they? I mean, sometimes we depend more on our human institutions and our man-made answers and our human wisdom than we do on the wisdom of God. See, we like the illusion of control. Listen to me. Many Christians are more interested in personal development than spiritual growth because it leaves their illusion of control intact. So in the next couple of verses, the psalmist gives us two reasons why we can trust the Lord. First of all, because he is consummately able to help you. He is able to help you more than any other source that you can find or imagine. My help comes from the Lord. Now stop there for a moment. Do you notice that word Lord is in all capital letters? When you see that in your Bible, do you know what that means? That means it's a translation of the word from which we get Yahweh or Jehovah. That it is a translation of the word that refers to the covenant God of Israel. And what the psalmist is telling us is that the covenant God of Israel is his helper, the Lord who made heaven and earth. Listen, I don't know what your trouble is today. I don't know what you are facing, but I do know this. The Lord is bigger than your problem. The psalmist opened the psalm by looking at the hills, but now he looks beyond the hills to the one who made the hills, the maker of heaven and earth. Listen, if God is the creator of all things, then he is sovereign over all things that he made. And by sovereign, I mean that he has authority over all that he made. Nothing is beyond his reach and control. So let me ask you, what issue do you have that he can't help you with? On what subject can he not speak authoritatively? About what problem does he not have wisdom? He is the maker of heaven and earth. Do you believe that this morning? I mean, really? There's a second reason why we can trust the Lord. And that's because he's constantly alert to your need. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. I have a 4-year-old grandson who is all boy. He is a linebacker in the making. I refer to him as a brick on legs. His motor has two speeds, on, off. I guess maybe you could say it's wide open or low idle. I learned something early on in my experience with Marcus. If you're watching Marcus, you probably shouldn't doze off, because you have no idea what could happen in just a few minutes. How often have we heard parents who just experienced something tragic make this comment, "I just looked away for a second." God never looks away. He never dozes off. He's always alert. He always sees your need. Folks, this is a contrast to the false god of the Canaanites. The false gods of the Canaanites who can't answer your prayer, who can't watch over and keep anybody. Every person who worships a man-made idol has to explain one thing: why their God can't take care of anybody. So the Canaanites attributed human characteristics to their gods. They believed that their gods drank, sometimes got drunk, ate, slept. You know, in ancient literature, a sleeping god was one who was unresponsive to the person calling out for help. You remember the story of Elijah? I mean, Elijah, this is a great story. Elijah was the lone prophet of Jehovah who went up in a contest against 450 prophets of Baal. And Elijah proposed a contest. He said, listen, let's both prepare a bull as a sacrifice. You guys, you pray to your God, you implore Him in any way you need to, and I'll call on the name of Jehovah, Yahweh, the Lord, the covenant God of Israel. And the God who answers by fire, He is God. Everyone agreed. So Elijah said, well, you know, there's more of you guys than me, so why don't you start? And so from early morning until noon, they prayed and they begged and they called out to their God, and Baal didn't answer them. He couldn't. So Elijah mocked them. He said, you know, maybe your God, maybe He went to the bathroom. Maybe He's on a trip. Maybe He's sleeping and you need to wake Him up. Now, for those of you who don't know the story, I don't want to leave you hanging. But Elijah called out to Jehovah God, simple prayer. And the Lord answered by fire, and the sacrifice was consumed. Do you know what the people of Israel said when God answered Elijah's prayer and sent the fire to consume the sacrifice? They said, the Lord, He is God. Jehovah is God. The one who is your helper is God. Why? Because He's alert to your needs and He answers your prayers. And ask the prophets of Baal, what happens when you call on a God who's asleep? Nothing. It can't. But the Lord who watches over you isn't like the self-made, self-proclaimed gods of this world. He never sleeps. He never slumbers. He's constantly alert. And so He knows when you need help, whenever it is that you need help. So what does it look like for the Lord to help you? The psalmist answers that question, and he summarizes his answer down into one very simple line. The Lord is your keeper. There's a very interesting shift that goes on in this psalm. I don't know if you noticed it or not. But the psalmist makes a shift from first person to second person. In the first couple of verses, everything is in the first person. I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord. And then he shifts to the second person. He will not let your foot be moved. He is your keeper. He will keep your life. See, the psalmist gets personal. He's talking to you. This is not the general plural you that is used so often in the Hebrew language. This is the specific, singular, intimate you. The Lord is your keeper. You realize that in verses 3 through 8 of this psalm, six times the psalmist uses that word, keep or keeper. In some translations, it's translated to watch or to watch over. It literally means to keep, to guard, to protect. That's what the Lord is doing for you. That's what His help looks like. He is constantly keeping His divine eye on you, guarding you and protecting you. Folks, I have wonderful news for you this morning. When you face the difficult, the dangerous, and the unexpected, you don't go into it alone. The Lord is your keeper. He guards you. He protects you. He watches over you. You know what Psalm 6:24 says? Excuse me, Numbers 6:24 says. It is a blessing that ends every synagogue service. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up His countenance upon you and give you peace. Many scholars believe that Psalm 121 is an exposition of that simple line, "The Lord keep you." See, we know what it means for the Lord to bless us, don't we? We've experienced His blessing in very tangible ways, and we may get confused from time to time, and we may distort our understanding of it a little bit, but the fact is, we understand what it means for Him to bless us, but do we understand what it means for Him to keep us? And that's what this psalm is really all about. It's about helping us understand what it means for Him to keep us. Can I make just one overarching statement about this? Don't miss this, because if you do, you're going to struggle with your understanding of this psalm. If you write nothing else down that I say today, write this down. What the Lord doesn't keep you from, He will keep you through. You know, so many people believe that if God doesn't keep you from the difficult and the dangerous and the unexpected, that He dozed off on you, that He isn't doing His job. He hasn't really been keeping you. I had a most interesting conversation that Tuesday night before my heart surgery. My nurse that night, my night nurse, was an immigrant from the Ukraine. And she had moved here several years ago, but she was born and raised in the Ukraine under atheistic communism, having nothing to do with her background. Her skill was questionable and her bedside manner stunk. On one of her trips into my room, she made this comment. She said, "You must be really upset." Those are my words, not hers. Hers were much more colorful. "But you must be really upset that you have to go through this." And my reaction to that was, well, no, not really. I mean, I have nothing to complain about. In fact, quite the opposite. I think God has been very good to me. I could easily be dead right now. Instead, I'm just having surgery. And her response was, "Well, I don't believe in God. And if I did, I'd be really upset," my language, not hers, "with a God who would let me go through this." Now, I expect that kind of thinking from non-Christians. But you know what I was struck by? The number of Christians that I heard that expressed the exact same sentiment. When we read that the Lord is our keeper, we tend to think that He should be keeping us from the difficult and the dangerous and the unexpected. But He doesn't always, does He? Sometimes He keeps us through it, not from it. So what does it look like for the Lord to keep us? Sometimes through it. Well, first of all, He keeps us stable when the way gets treacherous. He will not let your foot be moved. The road was often rough and the road was often uneven in that journey. It was easy to slip and fall, and quite honestly, a serious injury in the wilderness could be fatal. And he kept them steady and stable. Even when the road was difficult and treacherous, any of you ever need to be kept stable? Oh, maybe not physically. I mean, our sidewalks are pretty good. But don't you need to stay emotionally stable from time to time? Instead of being tossed around by all of the unevenness of life. See, he does that for you. He keeps you stable when everything else in life seems uneven. He relieves the oppression so you can function. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun will not strike you by day nor the moon by night. You know, dehydration and sunstroke in the mountains, the wilderness of Judea, that was a very real thing. And sometimes it would get so hot that you wouldn't even be able to function. You'd need to look somewhere for shade, which was often very difficult to find. You say, Don, don't tell me the psalmist really believed that the moon was dangerous. The psalmist probably didn't, but I'll tell you, a lot of people in the Middle East did. There was a saying that was very familiar. It referred to the hands of sin. I don't mean sin in the terms of your actions. But sin was the moon god of the Middle East. And there were many people who believed that the hands of sin caused all kinds of dangerous kinds of conditions and diseases. That's where we get words like, our English words like moonstruck and lunacy and lunatic. That's where they come from. And he relieves that oppression. He protects us so that we can continue to function. He protects us from the evil one. He will keep you from all evil. You know what that line reminds me of? It reminds me of that wonderful line in the Lord's Prayer. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Many of the translations say from the evil one. Why? Because there's a recognition that evil has its root in a somebody, in a person. It doesn't keep us from running toward evil, does it? But he never leads you into or pushes you toward evil. In fact, he often throws roadblocks in front of us, and he protects us from the evil one so that he can't entice us. He keeps us alive until he says it's time. It says he will keep your life. I have to be honest with you and tell you, when I read that on the night of August 11th, my first reaction was, great, he's going to keep my life. And then I thought for about 10 seconds, and I said, no, that's not what he's talking about here. Because life just doesn't work that way, does it? See, death is a reality that is caused by sin, yours and mine, and everybody else's. The good news in all of that is because of the work of Jesus Christ, I can live again, so can you. But he's not going to keep us from death, listen to me, unless he comes back and takes us out of here. Every one of us is going to taste death. There'll be no exceptions to that. So what's his statement mean here? If you're one of the 21 Coptic Christians who lost their heads, what does it mean when it says, he will keep your life? Who controls the number of your days? Well, this is important. It's not you. And it's not the evil one. God controls the number of your days. So what does it mean when it says that He'll keep us? It means that He'll keep us until we achieve the full number of our days and we finish what He's asked us to do. Can I ask you a question? I had to answer this question on August 11th. Do you want to be here 1 minute past when you've finished your task? Whatever He says it is. Do you really want to be here after He says it's time? Because He's going to keep your life to that moment. He oversees all of the activities of your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. You know, is there anything that describes the activities of your life better than coming and going? Going and coming. The Lord personally oversees all the comings and the goings of your life. See, I think most of us believe that God operates pretty much hands off. Many Christians would make really good deists. We believe that God started all of this. We're more than happy to admit that He was the Creator. But then He kind of leaves it all for it to operate on its own, including us. You know, someday I think we're going to get visibility into all of the places in our life that God interjected Himself to protect us and help us. Often without our awareness. He oversees all of the activities of your life from this time forth and forevermore. That forevermore part, that's crucial, isn't it? Do you know why the Lord, the covenant God of Israel and all who believe, do you know why He's your helper? Because He has an eternal inheritance that was prepared for you and is being kept for you, and watch this, and you for it. And if you are one of His, then He is going to make sure that you receive your inheritance. And He will oversee every activity of your life to make sure that happens. That's what the Lord's help looks like. And when it says He is your keeper, that's what He does for you. For just a few minutes this morning, I want to talk directly to those of you who are facing the hills this morning. You know, I seriously doubt that Ann and I are the only ones in this room that are walking through the hill country. We've noticed something in our life. Journeys through the hill country always seem to come in waves. Have you noticed that? She and I have both commented multiple times that the last 6 months have been the longest year of our life. Some of you will get that tomorrow. On top of my story, my brother is dying of cancer. My wife is surviving cancer. My niece is struggling with cancer. And my father-in-law had heart valve replacement surgery 3 weeks ago. That's been our last 6 months. But I'm here to tell you, I'm willing to bet we're not the only ones walking through the hill country. I want to say something specifically to you this morning. And if you're not in the hill country today, then remember it, because it's just a matter of time. And as far as I can tell, you really only have three alternatives. You can get angry at God and refuse to talk to Him. Most people who choose this alternative do so because they are absolutely convinced that they deserve better. Can you see the fallacy in that one already? But if you choose this alternative, let me tell you what your future looks like. You're going to become alone, isolated, disillusioned, and bitter. And you will probably at some point declare yourself to be an atheist because you're already thinking and acting like one. The second alternative is to try to control what you can't control. We do all kinds of things to make us feel like we're in control, don't we? And if you choose this alternative, you will begin to worry and you will forfeit any hope of peace. And you will go through life caught in that horrible conundrum of trying to hang on to a level of control that you never possessed. The other alternative, of course, is that you can look beyond the hills to the Lord who made the heavens and the earth. You say, Don, that's the alternative that I want. I really do believe everything that you said today. I believe that God is consummately able. I believe that He is constantly alert to my needs. I believe that He'll do all of the things that Psalm 121 says. But how do I activate that? How do I get Him to do that for me? Listen to me. He already is doing it for you. It's not a matter of you doing something so that He will act on your behalf. It is a matter of you forcing yourself so you can see or focusing yourself on the right things so that you can experience what He's already doing for you. In Philippians chapter 4, Paul makes this amazing statement. He says, "Don't worry about anything. Instead, pray about everything. Tell God what you need and thank Him for all that He's done. Then you will experience God's peace, which exceeds anything we can understand." Listen to me. If you are looking at the hills today and you are focusing on your problems and your troubles and you're wondering how you are going to solve the problem, then I can assure you that you are worrying and you have lost your peace. But if you will look beyond the hills to the Maker of heaven on earth, focus on that. See, prayer does two things for you. It forces you to focus on God and it forces you to assume the posture of dependence. And every time we do that, that's called trust. And when you trust Him, it's amazing how much you'll see that He's already doing for you. Father, thank You this morning. Thank You for the fact that even when we don't understand it and we don't see it and we don't realize it, that You're carrying us. Every one of us have those moments. We have those days. We have those weeks. Sometimes we have them for years. And I pray this morning for those who are looking at the hills that You would be their source of strength, that You would carry them, and they would find their strength in You. We ask it all through Jesus Christ. Amen.